Yeah, we did a good job setting the tone early, executing our stuff, getting into them, and playing with physicality. So it was good.
Execution, physicality, great play off the bench last night for the Pistons.
It was just all around great game from the Pistons yesterday.
And they win it 111-101 over Cleveland down at LCA. And that place just, the intensity keeps kind of ratcheting up down there.
I tell you, that sixth man, I'm telling you, the fans are something, man.
Yeah, it was really obvious last night in that game, especially late.
Yes.
As Cleveland was kind of making a push, they ended up tying it, I think, at about the 5.5 minute mark or so.
Mm-hmm.
But the Pistons just kind of kept them at arm's length.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that's exactly what you needed. And you look at just how efficient they were last night. I mean, Cade Cunningham finished with 23 points, which is a little underwhelming for him. But
he had some help, though.
Oh, absolutely. And I think that's the scoring yesterday was much more balanced.
It was.
So Cade finished with 23, but Tobias Harris had 20. Duncan Robinson caught fire last night. Oh. He was 5 for 8 from deep. He had 19 points. Asar Thompson in double digits, Jalen Duren with 11,
mm-hmm.
right? Like, it was just much more spread evenly, which is kind of what we had seen throughout the year.
And when you have that happening, when the Pistons are playing that way, they're just hard to beat. And, you know, they put the defense on you. It's just, they're just a hard team to beat.
They only turned the ball over 12 times yesterday.
Compared to?
20 for Cleveland.
I'm telling you, Cleveland, man, I thought they were playing bowling. I thought they were bowling.
Right.
At the bowling alley.
We scored 31 points off 20 turnovers. So that's a huge difference.
That's a big difference.
In this game. But, I mean, in terms of their field goal percentage, they shot 44% from the floor. They were much more efficient from the three. They shot 38%. So things are trending in the right direction. I told you yesterday, that's why I like this matchup more.
Yeah.
I think they match up much better against Cleveland.
I do, too. I was happy that we got that first game. We need to get that first game. Now we just need to get the game tomorrow and be up to nothing and going into Cleveland, because it's going to be difficult in Cleveland under that fan base. It's going to be a hard deal, but we can do it.
So Pistons go up 1-0, but J.B. Bickerstaff, who just got an extension, says that this is still going to be a tough series.
I mean, that's, you know, who we are defensively, right? That's what our physicality does. You know, two people. It puts them in tight spots, and then they got to make great plays in tight spots. You know, the aim is to wear you down as much as we possibly can. You know, we want to be as physical with you as we can. We want to put our body on you as much as we can, pick you up full court as much as we can, and then make this, you know, it's about a series, right? It's not just one game, and there's quick turnarounds, right? So now, you know, can we force your legs to be a little bit heavy? Because we're putting that weight on you, we're putting that pressure on you, and see if we can wear you down over a series. But it's not easy, right? It's not easy. And we know this is going to be a long, tough series for us, but we got to know and believe in our system and who we are, that we can sustain it and continue that physicality. And tonight I thought we did a great job keeping them off the free throw line while being physical, too.
Yeah.
Yeah, 100%.
Game 2 coming up tomorrow, 7 o'clock, Prime Video. Be there, be square.
Okay. Well, you know, but hey, check this out. At least you get ABC back now.
Thank God.
You know, after that recent blackout, viewers can once again watch WXYZ and WMYD on Xfinity. Parent company EW Scripps Company has reached a new agreement with Comcast, restoring both stations to the cable lineup as of yesterday. And in a statement, Scripps thanked viewers for their patience during the disruption and said it looks forward to continuing to provide local news, weather, live sports, and entertainment programming to Xfinity subscribers. How much you want to bet that, you know, the playoffs, you know, being on ABC the other day played a big deal? Not only that, but the finals are going to be on ABC.
Correct.
So, you know.
They're like, no.
Something has to give.
Yeah. Yeah, no, that's exactly right. Yeah, that was a bit of a problem for Game 7.
It was.
For us Pistons fans that have Xfinity. Locally, 35 days that blackout lasted.
It's like, man, they could have done that earlier than that. But, you know, sometimes it takes a little push.
But we're seeing that a lot more lately, it feels like.
Yeah, we
have. It was FanDuel Sports Network during the season last year.
Yeah.
That took a lot of games off the table for a lot of folks.
Mm-hmm.
Channel 7 now and Scripps that went through it. So it's all of these kinds, they don't all line up. Right, so they're not negotiating. The cable companies aren't negotiating with all of these broadcasters at the same time. Mm-hmm. So you get this every once in a while. You get blacked out. Usually they don't last this long.
Not over a month.
But 35 days is a really long time. Democrats celebrating a win in that special election up in the Thumb area, Saginaw, Midland, mm-hmm. Bay City. Mm-hmm. Chedrick Green won that special election. He had about 12,000 more votes. He won. He had almost 59% of the votes there. And his campaign spent millions, I mean, like over $1 million more than Jason Tooney did.
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
And again, what does this signal? Well, it could signal the fact that there is a rejection of Republicans. There is a rejection of the Republican policies, particularly at the federal level, because there was a lot of money put into this. So yep. I think it was a litmus test to a certain degree. Now, this is state politics, so it's a little different.
Yeah. But I also think, you know, I mean, people have said that, you know, the Democrats have momentum now. They've won some elections in state elections in other states. So they were saying maybe this momentum that may carry them into the midterms.
I tend to believe that this is an indictment on Republicans. That's what I believe.
Okay.
I believe this is a direct indictment on Donald Trump.
On Donald Trump. Okay.
I think this is a direct correlation to what we're seeing even here in the state to a certain degree. Mm-hmm. Saginaw County is a bellwether county here in the state of Michigan.
Yes.
They have properly predicted the presidential outcome, at least here in the state, mm-hmm. since, what, 92?
Mm-hmm.
So, and they've had a role in it since 2008. So that is a county that you look at. It is a county that you watch for.
Yeah.
So if you're a Republican running for governor here in the state of Michigan, you know, I think that should open some eyes.
Spend some time. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Spend some time there.
Yeah.
But it is something that I think is at least a precursor to what we could potentially see in November. Jason Tooney did say that he is going to run against him again for November, because this is just a special
election. This is a special election. That's right.
That he's going to restart this campaign, kind of called it the halfway point.
Yeah, okay.
If you will.
So Operation Epic Freedom? I mean, Operation Epic, which one was it? Because there's so many of them. It's economic
this
freedom.
This is Project Freedom.
Project Freedom.
Yeah.
But the military part is done, according to some people, right?
Yeah, Operation Epic Fury is over, according to Marco Rubio.
The Operation Epic Fury is concluded. We achieved the objectives of that operation. I'm not going to, you know, we're not cheering for an additional situation to occur. We would prefer the path of peace. What the president would prefer is a deal. He would prefer to sit down, work out a memorandum of understanding for future negotiations that touches on all the key topics that have to be addressed, a full opening of the strait so the world can get back to normal. He preferred that be negotiated through the route that Steve and Jared have been working and that all of us have been supporting. That's the route he prefers. That is so far not the route that Iran has chosen. And so the result has been that the United States has to do something about the fact that we're the only nation on earth that can do anything to open up a lane within the Straits of Hormuz to get product and to rescue these people that are trapped in there.
And that was his answer to the question of how does this ceasefire impact Congress's involvement in the War Powers Act?
Right.
When they need to
get authorization.
Vote on authorization
yes.
for this.
Mm-hmm.
And he goes, well, that's over. That military operation is over, and we are now moving towards Project Freedom, which Donald Trump has also temporarily paused.
Right.
At this time. He says, based on the request of Pakistan and other countries, the tremendous military success that we've had during the campaign against the country of Iran, and additionally the fact that great progress has been made toward a complete and final agreement with representatives of Iran, we have mutually agreed, while the blockade will remain in full force and effect, Project Freedom will be paused for a short period of time to see whether or not the agreement can be finalized and signed. And, of course, Project Freedom is the assistance by the United States to usher these ships through the Strait of Hormuz.
Yes.
So putting a pause on that, Marco Rubio saying Operation Epic Fury is over, and Donald Trump says we're moving towards potentially a deal. So we'll see.
And the Detroit People Mover is set to reopen to the public this morning, 6:30. It's going to open following weeks of repair after this mid-March windstorm. It forced the system to shut down. The Detroit Transportation Corporation says crews have spent that time restoring key components, including track communications and switch systems and train undercarriages. Test runs have been underway for more than 2 weeks to ensure everything is good, everything is operating safely, And officials say rider safety is the top priority. And the return comes at a busy time, supporting commuters and fans heading to those Pistons playoff games and the Detroit Tigers home matchups. And so service will also expand for upcoming events, with trains arriving about every 8 minutes. And as you know, they always are free.
Always
and,
free?
You know, if you miss hearing me, you know, on the train, that's because it was down. But they're, right. they're back up.
Now you're back. Hear Go hear Lloyd.
I'll be giving you directions.
Very cool. Jason Rowe coming up on the other side. Donald Trump looking to defeat Republicans who maybe disagree with him via the primaries. Is that a good idea? It's coming up on JR Morning. Well, as much as maybe that special election here in Michigan, in the thumb area, sided with Democrats, you look at what happened in Indiana and Ohio yesterday. In Indiana, Donald Trump, with his efforts, ousted seven state senators who fought against his idea to redraw maps in the state of Indiana. And Donald Trump has talked about this a lot. If you're a Republican and you're not on board with his agenda, he's going to primary you.
Yeah.
Case in point, we saw that in West Michigan with Peter Meyer.
Mm-hmm.
Ended up losing the seat to Democrats.
Mm-hmm.
So is this an idea that is going to help them in the midterms or hurt them? Jason Rowe, of course, the Republican strategist at Rowe Strategic, joins us to talk about that. Jason, good morning. Good to have you.
Good morning.
Is this a good idea for Donald Trump to continue down this road? I've largely advocated against it. I think it's a bad idea, but at the end of the day, this is where he's headed.
Yeah, I do think it's a bad idea. I mean, take Indiana, for example. I mean, these are state legislators who were elected by the people there to represent Indiana, and he's imposing his federal agenda on these state legislators. I do think it is probably going to hurt Republicans a little bit going into the general election, because for swing voters that might be looking for, you know, might be a Republican but like to see a little bit of a check on Trump, you know, they're now just going to assume that every Republican is just going to do whatever Trump wants at any time for fear of retribution.
Yeah, you know, Thomas Massie argued that these challenges are creating fear among Republicans and lawmakers afraid to go against Trump. You buy that?
Oh, no, I mean, I think that has been well established. I think the folks in Indiana probably thought that the threats would pass and they wouldn't really invest in these races like they have. That's the other thing. They've marshaled very significant resources into state legislative races that typically aren't that expensive. I mean, these were not competitive seats. These were Republican primaries, and you got millions being flooded into, relatively small constituencies. And the other thing that is unfortunate about this is that we're wasting a lot of money fighting these intramural battles, money that should be dedicated to making sure we're going to win. And, you know, that's winning in a very, very difficult political environment, and an environment that was caused by Donald Trump. So, you know, he's kind of put us in this fix, and then he is demanding that we all stick with him. And, you know, his numbers are terrible. We got, you know, I would say most handicappers are expecting that we lose the House, and the Senate's competitive right now. And if Haran doesn't resolve soon, this foreshadows a bloodbath for Republicans in November.
Well, and one of the things that even J.D. Vance has talked about often in interviews is that the Republican Party is a place where you can disagree amongst each other. And they've almost worn that as a badge of honor. But this kind of, I mean, to me, this goes against that.
Yeah, we can disagree with each other. We just can't disagree with Trump. I mean, you know, everything about the last 10 years is fealty to Donald Trump. I mean, and you look at how he handles people. If he gets in a fight with someone and they, you know, get on their knees for him, he gets over it. He moves on. I mean, everything just comes back to, you know, fealty to him.
And if they don't, they're Marjorie Taylor Greene.
Right.
Exactly. I mean, Marjorie Taylor Greene, and we've discussed this before, her crime was sticking to the positions that Trump had just months before, and holding him to his own rhetoric. And, when she stuck to the same position that he had maintained through the election on the Epstein files, she somehow became a traitor. Well, she didn't change. You know, Trump kind of reversed how he was viewing things. And so the expectation is that whenever he reverses, everybody has to reverse with him.
Jason, are we entering a phase now where primaries are less about voters and more about just political infrastructure?
Yeah, I mean, that's absolutely the case. I mean, the composition of primaries has also changed. You know, Republicans have underperformed in special elections and primaries throughout the year. And, right now, primaries are about who is most loyal to Trump, and special elections really have been driven by, Democrat enthusiasm to get rid of Trump. So everything is, in one way or another, a referendum on Trump.
Is it a referendum on what we saw last night in the Saginaw Bay City, Midland area, that a Democrat won that special election?
That was already a tough seat. I think, what Governor Whitmer did was rig the election. I mean, you went nearly two full years without any representation because, we were probably in a better position last year to win this than we are this year because of the shifting in the political environment. But the other thing in terms of composition, Republicans always did much better in special elections because who votes in special elections tends to be more affluent, college-educated voters. Mm. Those used to be Republican voters. Now they're Democratic voters. And so what we've seen has not been just a surge in Democratic enthusiasm. It's that those more civically engaged voters are the ones that tend to vote in special elections. And those same demographic of people just have changed their ideology. So this was going to be tough. I also think we got outspent dramatically in that seat. Mm-hmm. I thought we had a much better candidate, but when you look at how low the turnout is and who it is that turns out to vote. And then this is a seat that's always been, blue trending purple. And yeah, there was an opportunity. I also think had we, run this race in a normal period of time rather than, waiting 2 years, you could have gotten some bigger name candidates like Bill Schuette or Timmy Beeson, who's a state rep in Bay City, to jump in this race. And they took a pass because of, things changed. And, mm-hmm. and if they lost, they weren't going to, they were going to give up their seat. So, all the dynamics were against us. It would have been extraordinary if we won. It doesn't really say much that we lost.
Interesting stuff as always, Jason Rowe. Appreciate it. And you're going to be in for me for a couple of days next week.
I'm looking forward to it.
Take it easy on Jason, will you please, Lloyd?
Absolutely.
Yeah. Yeah.
All right. Have fun.
Jason, right. Thanks, man. Appreciate it. Yeah. Good to talk with
Pistons.
You.
Go Pistons.
Go Pistons.
That's exactly right. Also, Marco Rubio confirmed yesterday 10 crew members have died in this this backup in the Straits.
In the Straits. Yeah.
Yeah. They're sitting ducks. They're isolated. They're starving. They're vulnerable. It's something you talked about yesterday.
Yeah. Yeah.
Like these people are stranded out there.
They're stranded out there and they don't have food and yeah, it's not a good thing. And so I hate to hear that, people have lost their lives.
Marco Rubio says almost 23,000 civilians from 87 countries have been rescued though as a result.
Yeah.
So it's obviously top of mind for them as well.
Yes.
Coming up on the other side, the Pistons take a 1-0 series lead over the Cavaliers. They did it with defense and some timely scoring. Great bench play. All around great game. We'll talk about it next.
Yeah, they got obviously a lot of great players, a lot of guys who can make shots. It's not going to be easy. It won't be an easy series, but I think we execute, do the dirty work, get all the 50-50 balls and just do what we've been doing all season to get to this point, I think we'll be in a good space.
That was Jalen Duren, who looked a little more Jalen Duren-esque.
Yes, sir.
Last night. And that was really good to see because they needed him to step up in a big way. And he was, the connection, the chemistry that he and Cade have together is something special.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, they are, the way that they play together is pretty special. And he ended the night 11 points, 12 rebounds, a big part of their success last night.
And I think also that, Cleveland thought that Cade was the only one who could beat them. So they would double team him a lot of times, and try to keep him. I mean, he scored 23 last night. But the rest of the team came alive. You can clamp down on Cade, but you better make sure you clamp down on those others, too.
Yeah, he was distributing the ball, too. He had 7 assists on the night, which is absolutely huge. Eric Vincent's the Detroit Pistons reporter for ClutchPoints.com and rejoins us again this morning. E, good to have you back.
Yes, sir. Good to be here. How you guys doing?
We're well, and it's good to talk after a win. And the Pistons got it done yesterday, 111 to 101 over Cleveland. What was the key to their success, did you feel, last night?
We saw a good balance yesterday. Like you said, Jalen Duren had a bounce-back game, really came out the gate, did a good job getting a double-double with 11 points and 12 rebounds. And they had six different scorers outside of, or not outside of Cade Cunningham, including Cade Cunningham, that finished in double figures. So we saw a lot last series of Cade and Tobias kind of carrying the water offensively. But a lot of guys showed up. Dennis Jenkins giving you 12 points off the bench. Even Asar Thompson with 11. I always say, like, cause a lot of fans will say, oh, all he has to do is play defense. He's too athletic and too skilled to just be only contributing on the defensive end. So when you had 11 from him, 19 from Duncan Robinson with some timely threes as well, and they did a good job of limiting the big scorers on the Cavaliers side and punishing their defense as well on the inside. I think the Pistons did a really good job of checking all the boxes to get that double-digit victory last night.
And, you know, let's talk about that moment, that 11-0 Cavs run, Eric. Game tie, crowd goes silent. You know, we've seen young teams just kind of fold there. Is that the kind of moment where you find out if a team has actually grown or just kind of been playing well?
It's definitely a sign of growth. I got to shout out my guy, Cody Davis, from the Detroit News. He asked J.B. Bickerstaff before the game, what are the benefits of playing a game seven, you know, being in elimination situations like that? He says these are the kind of moments that show you, you know, how you can respond to adversity. So if you can play basically three straight elimination games, you can be prepared for anything. So if your team that you're playing against is going on an 11-0 run, putting some pressure on you in the third quarter the way that they did, killed your double-digit drive or double-digit lead to bring the score down to, I think, damn near a tie at one point, the Pistons did a good job of not, you know, panicking, and they just played their game and they were able to still make things happen and then still finish up by double digits anyway by just playing together, sticking to their identity and not getting too pressured by the situation. Man,
I think defensively they played really well last night. Here's Tobias Harris on the defense.
I thought our defense was dialed in early in the game. You know, we just were in the moment of getting stops, getting plays offensively, figuring out ways that we can kind of get the mismatches we want, but just playing off of our, you know, off of our rhythm and our movement. And, you know, I thought overall we did a good job of attacking them and figuring out who we wanted to put in the plays and just finding our flow out there. So
12 steals, 3 blocks, 20 turnovers, in which they scored 31 points off of. Defensively, again, you go back to middle of season, that's exactly how
that's
they were playing.
They did, yeah.
Exactly what you want to see. That's Piston basketball, and basically everybody came and contributed too. We saw a Ron Holland sighting. He came in and gave some energy, helped create some turnovers. Asar still doing his great play as a defender. And then Kate Cunningham, who I think does not get enough credit as a defender, stepping out, taking on the challenge of guarding James Harden on the open floor, got a steal against him, showing that he's not just an offensive engine. That's why I always call Kate a top three, top five player, because a lot of people that they compare him to and put in the same conversation, they're really great on offense, but they don't shoulder the defensive load that Cade Cunningham has to deal with as well. So to see Cade, your superstar MVP caliber player, also contributing and giving that
effort, getting
on
down
the
on the floor
end,
scrapping for balls, and
absolutely, it means a lot to see that. So it was awesome to see that production from Cade to help out.
And you know, he didn't have to go supernova scoring wise, but his fingerprint's still all over the place. And to me, that's the version of Cade that makes Detroit even more dangerous.
That's what you want to see, exactly. It's, if you have him, you know, trying to score 45 points, I mean, you can live with that, but it's good to see the balance as well. And he'd like to play that way as well. He's really good at getting his guys involved, even in the fourth quarter. He had 3 straight plays to Jalen Duren where that pick-and-roll action that we saw all season was back in effect, dropping off 3 straight dimes to him for a dunk to get JD active and to really set off LCA as well. It was impactful. It was really cool to see Kate getting everybody involved and to see the guys actually reward him with some good production on the offensive end too.
Pistons win 111-101. They take a 1-series lead. Eric Vincent, always appreciate it. Thank you. We'll talk soon.
My pleasure, guys.
Yeah.
Thanks for having me.
Yeah, All right,
man.
You got it. Yeah, pretty cool. Game 2 coming up tomorrow, 7 o'clock Prime Video.
And
you got that.
You know, and once again, I was thinking about what you had talked about yesterday. Like, Dan Gilbert, how does he feel?
Right? I don't know. Look, it's fine. It's a fun little byline.
It's a fun little byline.
You know? Look, he has done tremendous things for the city of Detroit.
Absolutely, no
doubt. He has done a tremendous amount for the city of Cleveland.
Yes.
And I think that's what makes him a really special person, because he's rejuvenated, you know, two areas that were kind of down.
I mean, absolutely.
Detroit, obviously, bankruptcy and all of
sure,
that. That's we don't need to
go down that road again.
But yeah, I mean, to see his influence, his fingerprints on this, I think it's fun.
And to have, you know, I mean, you're in Detroit. The Pistons are in the playoffs. Your team that you own.
It's also not the first time this has happened,
right?
I mean, they've met in the playoffs before. It's really the first time recently where the Pistons have been good.
Yeah.
They snapped last night a 12-game losing streak to the Cleveland Cavaliers in the postseason. 12.
Yeah.
They lost 12 in a row.
And
so,
I think they say what the team, about 75% of the time, the team that wins the first game wins the series.
In the second round?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
Yep.
Look at you.
I'm just
over there smiling ear to ear. Hit the horn for Lloyd. There it is.
313, baby.
That's right. Coming up on the other side, gas prices remain high, coming down a little bit. We'll talk to Patrick Tahan at GasBuddy.com. Well, according to AAA, the average price of a gallon of gas is...
too much.
$4.40. In Michigan, the average cost $4.80. So beating the national average in the worst way possible.
Yes, yes.
But is there a light at the end of the tunnel? Could we see a respite on some of these prices? Might we see them come down? To talk about that, Patrick Tahan, the head of petroleum analysis at GasBuddy.com. Patrick, it's good to talk with you again.
Well, thanks for having me.
It seems like there are a lot of different factors as to why these prices have gone up the way that they have, particularly the last couple of weeks. What's contributed to that?
Well, the latest sharp increase that we saw compared to last week is really a heavy dose of refinery snags that developed. Several, BP's refinery in Northwest Indiana had a unexpected power loss week before last on Sunday night, compounded by maintenance that's also happening. I think most of the time you've probably had me on in the past couple of months, we've been talking about refinery maintenance season. Well, that's happening. And when an outage like BP's happens, when other refineries doing maintenance, there's limited ability for gasoline flows to remain consistent. Not only that refinery, but then another one outside Chicago, ExxonMobil Joliet, Marathon Refining in Robinson, Illinois, and Phillips 66 in Roxanne, Illinois. So all the refining issues, and on top of oil prices that had jumped early in the week last week after President Trump had signaled to his administration to be prepared for a longer blockade of the strait, which had sent oil prices sharply higher. So all of that is what happened at the pump, not only in Michigan, by the way, kind of a unique circumstance. Michigan probably should have gone above $5.
Wow.
Along with Illinois. But Indiana, which has a gas tax holiday of 17 cents, went up to the exact same amount that Michigan did. So I don't think I've ever seen that. But yeah, Ohio, Michigan, Indiana, Illinois all went up to as high as they could go without hitting the $5 a gallon mark.
So, Patrick, the question there, I guess everybody wants to know, when do we get a break at the pump?
Well, let's look at the numbers here this morning. I think we'll start seeing a little bit of that. You know, you'd mentioned looking at our data, we're at 483 this morning. Gas buddy data for a statewide average. That's down a half a penny. Don't be in a rush to really hurry and fill, although unless something happens in the Strait, that could change. But
right.
I think we'll get a little bit of relief this week. We're at 483. It wouldn't surprise me by the end of the week that we'll probably be in the mid to upper 470s. So long as these refinery issues get sorted out, which usually happens after about a week or two, we could probably see prices fall into the mid fours again after this, so long, again, as there's no new issues. I don't have a crystal ball.
Mm-hmm.
And if there's any new refining issues, of course, that could send prices back up. But hopefully some modest relief this week. But I feel foolish saying that because we're still in the upper fours, right? And even if it gets any better, it's going to be in the mid fours, which, by the way, prices in Michigan today, $1.66 above where they were a year ago.
I want to play you something that Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent said yesterday. He says that gas is expected to come down here in the next couple of weeks.
Corporate earnings are good. Employment is good. And this gasoline, this temporary aberration, will be over in a matter of weeks or a month.
Well, let's say everything stays status quo in the Strait of Hormuz at this point. Is that a realistic timeline?
Not even remotely close. I wouldn't look for gas to go under $4 this summer unless the Strait reopens. And as we all have seen, Iran now launching new attacks on the UAE, that appears as unlikely as ever. Even if the Strait were to completely reopen tomorrow, we're probably talking about Michigan prices that are either in the upper threes or low fours this summer. And that's going to be way, way higher than last summer when prices were in the low threes. So there's no circumstance in my mind, as this has been ongoing for 65 days, the world has missed out on a billion barrels of oil that would otherwise flow through the Strait. Global inventories are declining. Even the U.S., we exported nearly 99.2 million barrels of oil and refined products left our shores in the last 7 days alone. The president's inviting countries to buy our oil. They're doing exactly that. So until the Strait reopens, our inventories are being more and more depleted. Our SPR has fallen another 5 million barrels in the last week, and that's not doing really anything to cushion the blow here. So, you know, whatever you hear out of the administration, all thoughts aside, there's really not much in my mind that we'll see prices fall like a rock or you know, fall anywhere close to where they were prior to this situation. I think at best, as I mentioned, Michigan mid to upper $3 gallon range this summer.
So drivers here should brace for more pain before any type of real relief comes on the horizon?
Well, yeah, I mean, more pain. I think the same pain they've been dealing with the last couple of weeks is not likely to disappear. I think we'll be around $4 a gallon. I would even say that into July 4 now, even under the most ideal of outcomes, we could be still close to $4 around Memorial Day. Even if the Strait reopens, we're going to be, you know, mid to upper fours by July 4, because in the backdrop, it's, you know, when the Strait reopens, if and when that happens, it's not going to happen to, you know, everyone's saying, well, when it reopens, well, I don't know if it's just going to reopen or not in the way that we're all hoping it will. If it does, you know, maybe mid threes by the summer, or I should say by the middle of the summer. But we won't see any of those sub $3 prices showing up potentially for a year longer, because in the backdrop of those global oil inventories are declining, and it's going to take probably the better part of a year now to build those back up. And every day longer, it's going to take another week or so. So we're tacking on time to this. We're not talking about seeing, you know, those sub $2 prices that President Trump talked about in the State of the Union. You might not see that until 2027.
Mm. Patrick DeHaan at GasBuddy.com. We always appreciate your insight. Thank you so much. We'll talk soon.
My pleasure.
Yeah, you got it. Well, look, and the realities are that pain is not just felt at the gas pump. It's felt in a lot of different areas, too. Grocery store, things that are...
Farmers with the
fertilizer. And yeah, certainly. Yeah, and again, the problem here, I think, is twofold, because you've got the elevated cost of things for people when affordability was already a main issue.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, Donald Trump campaigned on that, and Democrats felt the wrath of it because of the election loss.
Yeah.
They're trying to own that now and take that to the polls. But you've got now everything that's going on in Iran, a ceasefire that is just holding on by a razor's edge. And you've got this... You're trying to make a deal to help open the Strait to help relieve some of the global pains here. It's tough. It's a tough spot to be in. And unfortunately for us, there isn't a ton of relief just yet.
No.
Yeah. Coming up next, 7 o'clock hour, get you caught up on a lot of the headlines. That special election held in the Thumb area. What does it mean for lawmakers here in the state of Michigan? It's next. 7 o'clock hour, Pistons with a big win last night. They win it 111-101. They take a 1-0 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers, snapping a 12-game playoff streak to the Cleveland Cavaliers. They've lost 12 straight playoff games in a row to Cleveland, and that all came to a crashing halt last night.
Lee, and let me tell you, it was not just Cade Cunningham. It was the other players as well. Cade's fingers were all over the place when it came to the game last night, but his teammates really, really came on. And, you know, they tried to double team Cade and keep him down. He scored 23. But he didn't have to go crazy last night because the rest of his team, they came alive yesterday.
All five starters were in double digits. Danis Jenkins, in 29 minutes, scored 12 points. He struggled a little bit from behind the arc, but was really, really productive
really?
Coming off the bench.
Yes.
And it's something that Cade talked about post-game, the bench play.
They make a lot of hustle plays with some of their auxiliary guys and stuff. So, you know, for us to have so much contribution off the bench, obviously Tobias and Duncan have been great, you know, all playoffs. But, you know, to have Ron come in and do a great job, DJ doing what he does, you know, top to bottom, it's huge for us to keep our intensity up, you know, and to have guys come in when guys are tired and keep the intensity high. So it was great.
I mean, Danis Jenkins played 29 minutes. For comparison, Duncan Robinson, who starts for them, played 28.
Wow.
So that's how important their mm-hmm. bench play is. It's how important, quite frankly, Danis Jenkins is to
yes,
this team.
Absolutely. Tobias, very good last night as well. Another good one, JD. Also, I mean, everybody was just, you know, playing their part, being a team yesterday. And it just really, it really looks good. And like I said, when you have Cade that's, you know, spreading it out, assists, all of that, you know, to me, that makes the team even more dangerous. But on the Cleveland side, you can't lose the ball. How many times did they lose the
20
ball?
20 turnovers.
You can't. And then we scored 31 off of those 20 turnovers.
Yeah.
You can't win a game, not at least not against the Pistons. You can't win a game.
Yeah, and the Pistons turned it over 12 times, which is a marked improvement
yes.
from last series.
Yes, absolutely.
Where they were living where Cleveland was living
they
yesterday.
They sure were, yes.
So, yeah, it was a really, really nice win. Really pleased to see how they played. And like you mentioned, the fact that Cade only scores 23 but was so important in that win. Mm-hmm. I absolutely loved it. Huge. Game 2 comes up tomorrow, LCA. What is it? A 7 o'clock tip, I believe, on Prime Video. 7
on
o'clock
Prime.
Tip tomorrow on Prime. Meanwhile, Channel 7 is back for Xfinity users.
Yeah, parent company EW Scripps Company reached an agreement with Comcast restoring the stations WXYZ and WMYD to the cable lineup as of yesterday. Scripps thanks viewers for their patience during the disruption and said it looks forward to continuing to provide local news, weather, live sports, and entertainment programming for Xfinity subscribers. I believe, you know, this has been going on for about 35 days. And I believe after, you know, the playoffs were on ABC, you know, over the weekend, and a lot of people didn't get to see it, I think that added to a little fire up under the behinds of the two players, Comcast and EW Scripps, because the finals are on ABC this year.
Right.
We couldn't have that going on. People were going to be upset.
Correct. So the fact that they came to an agreement is good. I've told you my kids love America's Funniest Home Videos.
Yeah.
And we call it the Funny Show. And so every Sunday they try to turn it on over the last couple of weeks
that
we haven't been able to watch it. So they're like, where's the funny show? Why can't I watch? You know, so
same thing for me with Abbott Elementary.
Right.
And I couldn't watch. So
you're
I
like, where's Abbott
so
Elementary?
So yesterday I played catch up. I went on demand and I pulled them up and I
caught
there
up. You
I'm
go.
Good now.
Very good. Caught it up. Also, a special election in Bay City and Saginaw and Midland yesterday. It goes to the Democrat, Chedrick Green, who beats Jason Tooney for that vacant, empty senator seat in the 35th district. It's been vacant for 16 months, and now they have representation there. We're going to talk a little bit more about that, what that means, coming up at 7:19 with Marjorie Sabaugh Thompson at Wayne State University. Obviously, it solidifies the power that Democrats had in the Senate.
Yeah.
But was this an indictment of sorts? If you missed our conversation with Jason Rowe earlier, he says no. They were outspent. Republicans were outspent by the Democrats to the tune of $1 million.
Mm-hmm.
That it was a product of timing, too.
Yeah, he thought if the governor had called a special election maybe last year.
Right.
They might have gotten a better chance for a Republican to get in that spot.
Right. So maybe it ebbs and flows.
Yeah.
But this wasn't the time. Jason Tooney does say he's going to run again, though, in November against Chedrick Green.
Because this was a special election, so he
Correct.
Can run again.
Correct. So this isn't for a full term.
Right. Exactly.
Yeah. So interesting. Nonetheless.
Also, Frontier Airlines moving quickly to pick up the pieces left behind by Spirit. that abrupt shutdown, setting up a battle among budget carriers at Detroit Metro. The Denver-based airline says it expects to capture a significant share of Spirit's former passengers, pointing to more than 100 overlapping routes. CEO Jimmy Dempsey says Frontier is exploring the possibility of buying some of Spirit's assets, including aircrafts. At Detroit Metro, Spirit served about 1.7 million passengers last year, a customer base that's up for grabs now.
7:12, time for WJR's Business Beat, brought to you by Shelving.com. We rack your world. Here's Jeff Sloan, the founder and CEO of Startup Nation, to spotlight the entrepreneurial tech and startup community on WJR.
Good morning. We all know business is hard, and succeeding in business is even harder. And as hard as it is, we simply don't need anything additive to make achieving success more challenging and less likely. Well, now LegalZoom, Inc., America's number one online legal services company, has just released data from a new survey of business owners, which reveals that 33% of small business owners say compliance requirements have prevented them from pursuing new business opportunities. The most often missed opportunities, according to business owners, include expanding into new areas, securing new partnerships or investment, hiring, and launching new products or services. Now, to better understand the current state of compliance, LegalZoom surveyed 1,000 small business owners across the U.S., and the data from the study reveals how compliance pressures influence confidence, risk exposure, and long-term growth plans. Business owners across the board are spending more time keeping their businesses compliant with a wide range of rules and regulations, including licensing and permits, contracts, tax compliance, employment law, and everything in between. Nearly half of business owners surveyed indicate that keeping up with compliance issues is simply taking more time than it did last year. And what makes these consequences harder to bear is that the rules themselves aren't even always clear. Nearly a quarter of business owners say they often or always feel unclear about what their compliance obligations are, let alone how to abide by them. Allison DeSantis, LegalZoom lawyer and senior director of product counsel, says this about the study's findings. When founders are spending hours each month on compliance paperwork and one in four are facing fines, it slows small business growth, she said. As regulations continue to evolve, small businesses need clarity, structure, and reliable support. So there you've got it. Business is tough, no doubt. Keeping up with the various compliance issues, making things even tougher. I'm Jeff Sloan, founder and CEO of StartupNation.com, the source for everything you need to start and grow your own business. And that's today's Business Beat on the great voice of the Great Lakes, WJR.
So Chendra Green was the big winner for the Democrats out in the Saginaw Bay City, Midland region of the 35th District for that vacant state senator seat that was left vacant by Karen McDonald Rivett when she won her congressional race.
Right.
And so for 16 months, nobody had been in that seat. And to me, it's crazy that
That's just too long, man. I mean, come on.
It's crazy that it even had gotten to that point. But Democrats win, and there was a lot of money spent in this race. What does that mean? What does it tell us about maybe the midterms, or what does it tell us about the state of Michigan? Marjorie Sabaugh Thompson is a professor of political science at Wayne State University and joins us this morning. Professor, it's good to have you. Thanks for joining us.
Good morning. I'm glad to be here.
What did you make of the outcome of the of that particular race yesterday?
Well, the state senate in Michigan runs every 4 years. So 2022 is the last time that that was an electoral contest. And Kristen McDonald Rivett won by less than 10 percentage points. Chedrick Green looks like he's going to win by more like 20 percentage points. So it's quite a big shift toward the Democratic Party. Probably, if I were writing a headline for a newspaper, I would probably say gas and diesel prices drive voters toward Democrats. And you know, it gives you some sense of a competitive race that really is not competitive. 20% point victory, roughly, is not a very competitive race.
And when you see that kind of margin, Professor, does that suggest voters are sending a message or just choosing between two candidates?
Well, it's hard to always say what voters are thinking when they vote. And special elections are always low turnout affairs.
Mm-hmm.
It's a little bit, the total vote so far, and they're still counting, so this will change a little bit, but it's about 62,000 votes in the 2022 with a, you know, statewide election. It was 116,000. So, you know, almost double, not quite double. So it's a little bit hard to read the tea leaves. One thing I think you can say is that Democrats are more motivated because you get a, you know, a much bigger turnout margin, mm-hmm. and turnout matters.
Yeah, so you mentioned gas prices if you're writing that newspaper headline as to why, maybe what went wrong here for the Republicans. Is this an indictment more on state Republican politics, or is this more an indictment on what we're seeing at the federal level?
I think it's an indictment at the federal level. People, in my experience, and I teach state politics, so it breaks my heart, but people really don't understand the differences between state and federal, and the federal gets so much more news coverage. That people are voting on things that are happening nationally between the two parties.
You know, and Republicans are downplaying this, saying that, you know, special elections don't predict November. Is that historically accurate?
Not necessarily. There's a lot of history of special elections being bellwethers, and it depends. You wouldn't want to pick just one, but there has been a pattern nationally of several other special elections where Democrats have done especially well, better than you would normally predict. And that's the case here. You wouldn't normally predict that this would be a 20 percentage point margin of victory, because this should be, by all accounts looking at it, it should be a competitive district, possibly even a swing district.
Mm-hmm.
So 20 percentage points is unexpectedly large.
Yeah, it's substantial.
I would say.
Let's play the what-if game. If you were put in charge of running the campaigns here in the state of Michigan for Republicans, what would you advise them to do based on what we saw last night?
I would pick places where I thought they might be at risk and concentrate on those instead of trying to expand the playing field. I think they need to play, in the sports terms, I think they need to play defense.
Interesting.
And you know, Tunney says this is only the halfway point because he's going to, you know, run against him again in November. Does Green have a real advantage now as an incumbent, even if it's only for a short time?
Normally, incumbents have an advantage. They have opportunities to get their names out there just by media coverage of what they do, and opportunities to do casework and have, you know, meetings with constituents in the district where they help them solve problems. And that matters. You know, you hear about your neighbors getting help from the elected official, and, you know, that's why incumbency is helpful.
Really interesting, and obviously something that that we'll see how this plays a role later on this year. Marjorie Sabaw Thompson, thanks so much. Really appreciate your time this morning.
Thank you.
Yeah, you got it. Meanwhile, interesting piece out of NerdWallet.
Mm-hmm.
One in three Americans say they have too many credit cards.
I believe that.
And you know, you've got advisors that will tell you, you know, cutting back on your credit cards, consolidating debt, that's important because the more you have open, mm-hmm. right, that can affect your credit score, things like that.
That's right.
But just look at the sheer numbers in which our debt, our credit card debt as a country,
okay.
has gone up. Obviously, our debt, our federal national debt, is buku. Mm-hmm. It's off the charts.
Right.
But if you go back 20 years, right, okay. 2006, the credit card debt amongst all Americans was about $770 billion.
Okay.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
It's a lot.
2006 or any year. It's a lot.
20 years later, it's at an all-time high. $1.39 trillion of credit card debt here in this country.
Mm.
And why is that? Could it be affordability? Things are too expensive. People are overexerting themselves, mm-hmm. right? Things like that. If you can't, if your output isn't what the input is,
yeah,
that's a problem.
Yeah.
Right. And so people lean on those credit cards. But it's just shocking to me. First of all, I didn't have a credit card till very late in life. I wouldn't get one.
Okay. I had one. I think I had one probably when I was 19. And I think the credit limit was like $500.
Yeah, sure. You sure.
Know, something like that.
Yeah, manageable.
Yeah. You know, and I'm sure I ran it up to 500
a couple of times.
Yeah. You know, a few times. Yeah. But yeah, you know, years later, you know, I had several credit cards, like department store credit cards and all that. And uh-huh. I refinanced 100 years ago
sure.
and got rid of all of that, man, because it was yeah. just crazy. It was just too much.
It's too much. And it's almost like, you know, these streaming services now. Like, tell me how many streaming services you pay for. You probably don't even know.
Yeah. I got an idea.
You can think of them.
I can think
of them.
But
there's probably other stuff.
More,
that right? Exactly.
Exactly.
So it's like, oh, that's right. I did open that line of credit uh-huh. over there. And uh-huh. I bought that couch. And you yeah. don't even think about it.
No.
But, yeah, people say they have too many credit cards.
God, trillion now.
Almost $1.4 trillion as of early this year. Unbelievable. Ooh. Coming up on the other side, is Iran Vietnam for Donald Trump? We'll explore next. Interesting piece in the Detroit Free Press with the claim that what we're seeing with the war in Iran is following a dangerously similar pattern, and one that may closely resemble how the United States slid deeper into the Vietnam War. And mm-hmm. maybe some parallels to what we're seeing, what lessons we can learn, and potentially how we avoid those same pitfalls as we experienced in Vietnam. Rusty Hills wrote the piece. He's the former chair of the Michigan Republican Party and lecturer at the Gerald R. Ford School of Public Policy at the University of Michigan. And Rusty joins us. Rusty, it's good to have you.
George, to see you. Wonderful to talk to you, Chris and Lloyd. Good morning.
Good morning.
Well, let's talk a little bit about where you think there are the similarities between what we're seeing in Iran and what we saw in Vietnam.
Yeah, good question. So, you know, they say that we learn from our own mistakes, but the wise person learns from someone else's. And I guess that's what I'm trying to do is let's learn from some of the mistakes of the past. And I think two from Vietnam are you want to beware the smartest person in the room, because my experience is by definition that person isn't. And the other lesson is that war never goes as planned. And we've seen this play out time and time again, both in our own history, and frankly, from other countries as well. First case was Robert McNamara, the former Secretary of Defense. And I'm old enough to remember those days. In fact, I just got rid of my draft card a couple months ago, as a matter of fact.
Wow.
And I can remember Vietnam. You know, McNamara ran Ford Motor Company. He was into statistics, wanted to measure everything. Had all about kill ratios and how many of the enemy we were taking off the battlefield. But at the end of the day, all those numbers didn't add up because we were the ones that ended up leaving Vietnam and the North Vietnamese won. And the other thing is that, you know, war just doesn't go as planned. And we see this playing out right now before our very eyes in Iran. Look, there's no question we've got the greatest military in the world, and we've completely decimated Iranian Air Force and naval forces. It's been a triumph, and really, you know, it speaks volumes about what a great military we have. And my hat goes out to all those who service our country in the military. But the Strait of Hormuz is still closed. And, you know, it's because they've been able to use these drones and mines and small ships to interdict shipping in such a way that, you know, it's just completely fouled up the price of oil and gas. And you see that every time we go to the pump. So what we're doing right now isn't working. I think wise people need to step back and say, okay, what do we need to do to change to accomplish what we want to do in this conflict?
And, you know, Rusty, when you look back at Vietnam, one of the biggest criticisms was the inability to pivot when things were not working. How important is it for an administration to publicly acknowledge when something needs to change? I mean, is there a risk of just staying the course simply, you know, to appear weak?
You know, I think that's there's a tendency there. Yeah, I do believe that. And look, I'm not looking for the president or the secretary to do some big mea culpa. They don't need to apologize to me. But I do think they need to reevaluate. First of all, what is our goal? Let's figure that out first. And then if we're not accomplishing it, what changes do we have to make to get there? Years ago, I read an interesting book that compared the British with the Americans and how the British in their jungle fights in Malaysia and some of these others understood that, you know, these big army battles that we had in World War II with like Montgomery and Patton, that worked in Europe. That doesn't work in the jungles and in Asia. So they had to do a completely different strategy to try and win over villagers and isolate who their enemy really was. And so they learned and adapted. And that was one thing that we just didn't do very much of in Vietnam. That's what I'm asking to do now is let's learn and adapt to make sure the most important thing we can do is safeguard the men and women who are in our military. Mm-hmm. And so let's figure out what we can do to keep them safe and accomplish our mission as quickly as we possibly can.
You talked about the process that Donald Trump went through before taking this military action. The assumption perhaps was that this was going to be really fast, that he would go in, hit the Iranians, hit the regime, and then get out. They would fold. Everything would be done in just a couple of weeks. Nice, neat package. Obviously, that hasn't been the case. Do you believe that what we've seen since then, since the start of this conflict, that everything has been planned out meticulously, or do you feel like they're kind of shooting from the hip a little bit?
Well,
because I'll tell you, it just seems like the blockade, for example, I don't know if that was part of the initial plan.
Yeah, I wonder that myself. It seems to me it has the whiff of ad-libbing is sort of the way I view this. Mm-hmm. I understand that war doesn't go as planned, and there's always an element of that. You know, I'm sure that was true in some of our successful conflicts, like World War II, for example, where you adapt to changes on the battlefield. So I get that happens, right? I mean, you have to change on the fly sometimes, but it seems like there's a little too much of that, again, partly because I'm not clear what the end game is. I'm not sure anybody is. I don't know that you are, Congress, the public. What is the goal? I mean, do we want a popular uprising? Do we want to get rid of, you know, all of the religious, you know, running of the theocracy of Iran? We're trying to get rid of the enriched uranium there. We certainly want to open the Strait of Hormuz. We know that's there. Mm-hmm. So what do we have to do to get that? Let's figure that out.
And, you know, when history looks back at this moment, Rusty, what do you think is going to matter more, just the initial decision to act or how the leaders adjusted, you know, once it really kind of set in?
You know, that's a great question. I think history will look back at the outcome. You know, you generally judge these things by results. Fortunately, we've only had like 13 or 14 service members. And fortunately is the wrong word because you never want to lose a single military member, right? I mean, that's a tragedy that lose forever with the family. But we've been able to keep casualties low so far. I'd like to continue to do that. What can we do to accomplish the goals in the most efficient, quickest manner that safeguards as many of our people in uniform as possible? And again, if the president and secretary can't enumerate that, then I think Congress needs to take a much bolder stance in holding their feet to the fire. That's why I said we need something like the Fulbright hearings where some brave senator or representative will say, look, we need to hold everyone accountable. Let's bring them before Congress, explain what's going on. I'm not talking about giving away secrets. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about being really clear about what our goals are and, you know, making that crystal clear so the American public understands why we're there and what we're doing.
A really interesting piece in the Detroit Free Press. Rusty Hills, thanks so much for your time this morning. Don't be a stranger. Let's talk again soon.
I love it. Thanks, Chris. Thanks, Floyd. Right. Have a great day.
You got it, Rusty. You do the same. Coming up on the other side, a new plan being bandied about in Lansing to improve accountability and to increase public access to state reports. We'll talk about it with Representative Ann Boland next on JR Morning. So there's a plan in Lansing to help improve transparency and public access to government information. And look, I think lawmakers should carry around see-through folders.
They should.
In everything that they do.
Absolutely.
And Ann Bolin said that residents deserve easy access to reports and records that are produced by state departments so they can better understand how taxpayer money is being used. And Representative Ann Bolin, who also chairs the House Appropriations Committee, joins us this morning to talk about it as part of our Capitol Report. Representative, it's good to have you.
Well, great to be back. Thank you for having me.
So what is this bill all about? What would it do for people?
All right. So what this bill would do is place into statute and cement our efforts for more transparency and accountability by requiring all legislative reports to be posted on a state website in a searchable database, and that they would be maintained there. So for easy access for the public, for lawmakers as well, we require these reports, and so, you know, they shouldn't just be for our eyes only. They should be for the public, as they serve a public purpose.
And, you know, do you think, too, that, you know, government sometimes checks that transparency box without kind of making information truly usable for the public?
Well, absolutely. As a former clerk, I understand how extremely important it is. I've been a champion of transparency since I was a local elected official. But the records are only as good as our ability to retrieve them. And so that's why I fought very hard in this year's budget to get into the boilerplate or the narrative to the budget, a requirement that all of these reports not only be posted to a website, but that they also be archived. So for future administrations, when they change, we know in January we'll have a change in administration, mm-hmm. that those reports, that history will be there for people to access. We saw when the Snyder administration left, you know, there were a lot of dashboards, accountability measures, and they were all wiped out. So I want to prevent that from happening again. That's why I'm pushing the boilerplate, and this will put this into statute so nobody has to fight over it later.
Yeah, Michigan is often cited as one of the least transparent state governments across the country. There was also a website that was put into place in the name of transparency. It was the Michigan Transparency Network. There were problems with that. How does this differ from that?
Well, the Michigan Transparency Network, if you're referring to Jocelyn Benson's
yes.
network, it was dismal. It continues to have problems. Just this week, I found something of mine that they don't have information posted, and they have a notification of failure to file. That is not true. That network is more for campaign finance, candidate filings, public financial disclosure. What this is an effort for all departmental websites. So if you want to know how long it took for Eagle to issue a permit, you'd be able to look on that. If a department failed to do something, if we want to know, you know, we've had a lot of conversations about these vacant positions, these ghost employees, those reports would be available for the public as well. They shouldn't have to dig or request them under FOIA. They are public information and they should be accessible.
Do you expect any resistance from this idea? And is there a cost or logistical challenge to centralizing all of this information?
Well, I would say I don't think that there's a real challenge. I think there's real promise in getting this across the finish line. And the reason is that we were successful in pushing it in the budget, current year budget, in the boilerplate, like I mentioned. This is not a difficult task to achieve. You know, it is very easy to save a document as a PDF and just to upload it to a website. We want to make sure that, of course, our state website is accessible, but, you know, ADA accessible as well as easy to see. That's why we've called for it to be placed in a conspicuous place on the website. Ideally, this bill calls for it to be in a collective space. So if you're posting it to the department, it's very easily just push a button, a link to post it to a central website.
One of the issues that we saw with the transparency website was that it was from a third-party vendor and there were issues there. Would this be similar? Would you need a third-party vendor, or is this something that you can handle in-house?
I think it can be handled in-house, but I will tell you that the IT failures across the state for the last 8 years have been dismal. They've cost the state a lot of money. We have no objection to putting money forth to make sure that this happens and that it works properly.
If this passes, could this become a model for other states looking to improve transparency?
Absolutely. I think it could become a model not only for other states, but for our local municipalities.
Interesting.
You know, the same rings true at the county or local level, that these you know, these are the public's documents. We should have no fear in posting them.
Yeah, no doubt. Representative Ann Boland, really appreciate your time. Thanks so much, and we'll talk again soon.
All right, thank you again. Have a great day.
Yeah, interesting. Look, any transparency measure, I'm for.
Absolutely.
Any transparency measure.
Listen, you know, it's the taxpayers' money. We need to know what they're doing with it. We vote these people in. We need to be able to follow what they're doing.
Maybe you don't care, right? Maybe you go through life and you're too busy. You're too busy going to work.
And a lot of that happens until it hits you.
Well,
until
sure.
Until it affects you.
But you got bills to pay. You got mouths to feed. You got stuff to do. And maybe you just don't care because you've got other things that are more pressing right in front of you. You pay your taxes and you walk away.
Mm-hmm.
But there are other people that are going to go, well, wait a second. Hold on.
Mm-hmm.
We've seen how you spend our money. It's ridiculous.
Exactly.
Or everything is too inflated. We have too much money going here or there.
And not enough here.
Right.
Yeah.
I think if you are the person that is just more focused on the tunnel, you're more focused on what you're doing, that's okay.
Yeah.
I get that. And if you're somebody who wants to check on a couple of things, you should be able to do that. It shouldn't be under some sort of, you know, it shouldn't be secret. How your money's being spent.
The People Mover has been closed since March. It was a storm, a high wind event that did some damage to the undercarriage and some other parts of the People Mover, so it had been closed down. It opened up this morning, 6:30.
Very
it's back
good.
Open, absolutely free. Good time for it to happen because you got the Pistons playing downtown, you got Tigers playing downtown, you got Bruno Mars this weekend, you got the Iran, the D5K run, all that's going on, so it's a good time for it.
Yeah,
to be up.
Get people around.
And hear me say, this is the Huntington Place station.
Boom. That's a pro right there. It's a great time. Because, look, we're entering the season where we are getting busier and busier.
Summertime, a lot of stuff happening downtown. And you definitely want to.
I mean, a lot of concerts.
It. Oh, yeah.
Obviously, Tiger games. Mm-hmm. The Pistons are
making a run.
A push here. So, any way we can traverse downtown is a good thing.
Yeah.
We'll take a break. Coming up, get you caught up on some of the headlines. Also, what's up with our weather? A little more extreme, it feels like, lately. It's next.
Yeah, they got obviously a lot of great players, a lot of guys who can make shots. It's not going to be easy. It won't be an easy series, but I think we execute, you know, do the dirty work, you know, get all the 50-50 balls and just do what we've been doing all season to get to this point. I think we'll be in a good space.
That, Jalen Duren last night after a really nice effort by him, 11 points, 12 rebounds, couple of blocks, was active all over the floor as the Pistons win 111-101. They take a 1-0 series lead over Cleveland.
It was just an all-around good effort last night. It was the way the Pistons have been playing through the regular season, why they got to 60 games, 60 winning games, because of how they played, and we saw a lot of that last night.
59-46 at the half, and Cleveland pulled within,
they tied it up about
5 minutes left in the fourth quarter, and then the Pistons just kind of turned it on again, right? And that's, to me, pretty standard NBA basketball.
Yeah.
Right. You get a lead. You kind of lax up a little bit. You don't take it quite as forceful as you were earlier in the game.
Yeah.
But then when you need to turn it back on again, you have to. And that's exactly what we saw last night. That's why I think the Pistons are in a different spot than they were last year. Obviously, they got the playoff experience last year with a lot of these young guys, but they're able to do things that a very veteran laden team is able to do.
And I think a lot of teams think, too, as great as Cade is, a lot of teams think, you know, if you clamp down on Cade, then you can win the game. Not necessarily so. I mean, Cade scored 23 yesterday, right? Was it 20 or 23?
23.
He scored 23 yesterday, but he, you know, so many assists, he spread the ball out. And then the other team members of the Pistons are dangerous too. So, yeah, you can clamp down on Cade if you want to, but what are you going to do with the other four that are out there on the field that are doing harm to you?
Well, they scored 27 off the best bench. Danis Jenkins in 29 minutes scored 12. And here's Cade Cunningham talking about those players that step up when the starters need a little rest.
They make a lot of hustle plays with some of their auxiliary guys and stuff. So, you know, for us to have so much contribution off the bench, obviously Tobias and Duncan have been great, you know, all playoffs. But, you know, to have Ron come in and do a great job,
DJ doing what he does. You know, top to bottom, it's huge for us to keep our intensity up, you know, and to have guys come in when guys are tired and keep the intensity high. So it was great.
So up 1-0 on Cleveland. Game 2 tomorrow down at LCA. That's on Prime Video, 7 o'clock tip. We'll talk to Eric Vinson, who's on the Pistons beat, coming up at 8:35. Meanwhile, Channel 7 is also back, which is good news.
Well, and I think they got a little fire lit up under them because of these playoffs that happened last week. But, yeah, parent company EW Scripps, they reached a new agreement with Comcast, restoring WXYZ and WMYD, that's Channel 20, restoring both stations to the cable lineup as of yesterday. And the Scripps thanked the viewers for their patience during the disruption. Listen, I think they said, listen, the finals are going to be on ABC. We cannot have this. We're going to have and I'm sure people, you know, gave them a bad time after this week, last weekend's play where they had some playoff games, including ours.
Yeah, it does stink when you flip on Channel 7 and it's like, sorry,
can't see it. It's a problem.
Nothing to watch here.
Yeah.
Yeah, no, it is a bummer, but they got it worked out. After a little
Thank
over
God
a month.
For that.
Mm-hmm. Meanwhile, Chedrick Green won in that 35th Senate special race yesterday, and you know, for the people of Saginaw and Bay City and Midland to not have Senate representation for 16 months,
come on,
is crazy. I mean, I'd been very critical of the governor for that, for not calling that much sooner.
Because we kept saying, when is it going to happen?
Right.
When is she going to call it?
Yeah, it became
strategic?
Too much.
Was it strategic?
It could be. Yeah, it could be. I mean, maybe she saw what happened in 2024 and goes, uh-oh.
Mm-mm, maybe I don't do it now.
Maybe now's not the time.
Yeah.
But that to me...
But that's not fair, though, to the constituents there, man.
It's not fair.
It's not.
And that to me is, you're playing politics over getting people their duly elected representation.
Yeah.
So, I didn't like that. But Chedrick Green did win, and he's going to win by a huge margin there.
Mm-hmm.
Saginaw County is a bellwether county here in the state of Michigan.
Yeah.
They are often very predictive of what happens in general elections.
Mm-hmm.
They've correctly identified and voted for the president who ended up going on to win elections since, 2008?
Mm-hmm.
So they're very much, whatever they do in Saginaw County, you can bet that this is something that that is going to show up on the national stage. Now, whether that has a direct correlation or not to the midterms, we'll see. But Chedrick Green was able to outspend his opponent in that race, Jason Tooney, over $1 million.
Well, and they're going to have
a lot of that's out-of-state money.
They'll have a rematch because Tooney's going to run again.
He is going to run again for the actual
term.
Coming up in November. Also, Marco Rubio addressed the media yesterday from the White House on Iran, and some notable things came out of that. He was asked about Operation Epic Fury and how that particular mission coincides with potentially Congress needing to vote to authorize military action.
The Operation Epic Fury is concluded. We achieved the objectives of that operation. I'm not going to, you know... We're not cheering for an additional situation to occur. We would prefer the path of peace. What the president would prefer is a deal. He would prefer to sit down, work out a memorandum of understanding for future negotiations that touches on all the key topics that have to be addressed, a full opening of the strait so the world can get back to normal. And he preferred that be negotiated through the route that Steve and Jared have been working and that all of us have been supporting. That's the route he prefers. That is so far not the route that Iran has chosen. And so the result has been that the United States has to do something about the fact that we're the only nation on earth that can do anything to open up a lane within the Straits of Hormuz to get product and to rescue these people that are trapped in there.
Meanwhile, Donald Trump yesterday announced that Project Freedom, which was the efforts to escort some of these ships through the channel, he paused it for a short period, according to the president. He says because negotiations with Iran show great progress. The Pakistani prime minister said that he's grateful to the president for his courageous leadership and timely announcement regarding the pause of Project Freedom. President Trump's gracious response to the requests made by Pakistan and other brotherly countries, particularly the Kingdom of Saudi Arabia, will go a long way towards advancing regional peace, stability, and reconciliation during a sensitive period. So You've got the mediators now that are saying that there is some forward progress here, backing up a little bit what the president said. So that's the latest on that, and hopefully that rings true.
Well, on Truth Social this morning, the president warned if Iran doesn't come to a deal that the bombing will start again.
Yeah. Yeah, so this is...
I mean, you know, Are we done with the bombing or are we not done with the bombing?
Well, I think the president is using that rhetoric as leverage to try to get a deal done.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah.
The People Mover had reopened this morning at 6:30. It was down since mid-March because of that windstorm we had back then. They had to restore some key components and some track communications and switch systems and train undercarriages that were damaged because of that windstorm. Test runs have been underway for the last couple of weeks to ensure everything is operating safely. So officials say rider safety was the top priority, and they call the work an investment in some long-term reliability. The People Mover return comes at a busy time, supporting commuters and fans heading to those Pistons games and Tigers games and a lot of other special events and concerts going on downtown. So make sure you take a ride on the People Mover. It is absolutely free.
Absolutely free, and you'll be directing people where they need to get to.
I'll be telling you where to go.
Coming up on the other side, is our weather getting more extreme?
It's getting to the point where it's almost kind of normal. Does it really seem extreme now?
Is it something that we need to get used to?
Yeah.
Paul Gross joins us next on JR Morning. Well, a story in the Detroit Free Press says that major flooding across Michigan is not an extreme event anymore. It's becoming a pattern driven by climate change, according to the report in the Free Press. And you've got heavier rainfall, warmer winters, rapid snow melt, rivers and dams that are being overwhelmed. Mm-hmm. We've seen that up north. Stormwater systems that were not designed for this volume of water. So this is becoming much more of a frequent thing and less of what we would include in the extreme category these days. Paul Gross is the meteorologist emeritus at WDIV and joins us to talk about it. Paulie, good morning.
Well, hi. How are you guys this morning?
Good.
We're well. First of all, what's driving the change? I don't know that I've really noticed much of a difference, but that doesn't mean that things aren't changing statewide.
No, things are changing, and there was a study done by Climate Central that shows the northeastern part of the country, and when we say northeast, we're talking about from the Mississippi River eastward across the Ohio River up into New England. We're seeing, if you look at just the most extreme precipitation events, the top 1% of those events, those have increased 45% to 60% since the 1950s. So we are without question seeing an increase in the most extreme precipitation events.
And I know we had that early season tornado this year. Really, it kind of caught people off guard. Does that signal a broader shift there?
Well, we're seeing a broader shift toward more warm air coming in earlier in the spring and also staying later into the fall. And so in particular in the spring, where you still have, you know, those cold air masses coming down, but now you're starting to surge those warmer air masses northward. What we're seeing now are more clashes of that and more severe weather outbreaks happening earlier in the season. And even what we used to call Tornado Alley, or maybe I guess people still call it Tornado Alley, is even starting to tend to shift a little eastward into the deep south as opposed to the south central plains. So we are seeing some definite shifts.
I know this might be a little bit out of your realm of expertise, but we've talked a lot about aging infrastructure for a long time and how that plays a role in some of the events that we're seeing. Our current infrastructure just isn't capable of keeping up with this. Is that the summary?
Well, keep in mind, a lot of the infrastructure, and we're talking about like the stormwater runoff, those big pipes underground, mm-hmm. those things, they were designed like 50 to 100 years ago to handle what was, you know, a certain top-tier rain event back then. Back then, those were much more rare. So what is happening is that those events that exceed the capacity of the system are becoming much more common now. So basically, we are changing what's normal. We are actually in a new normal now. And just to maybe put it in a way that people can really relate to, a friend of mine, a meteorologist who's just retired actually down in Houston, he was telling me several years ago that they had four straight years in Houston with a 500 to 1,000 year rain event in four straight years. Mm. So again, what used to be that rare an event is becoming a much more common event now.
Are there parts of Michigan, Paul, that are more vulnerable than others, or is there something affecting the entire state?
Oh, it's the entire state. I mean, you look at some of the big flooding events that we've had, you know, down here in the metro area. I vividly remember the summer of 2021 in June and July. We had extreme rainfall events. And then just the year before in 2020, we had the big rain event that caused the failures of the Edenville and the Sanford dams. But then just last year, we had the historic catastrophic ice storm up north. And so, you know, and then this spring, we had the heavy snow. That snow melted. That raised the water table in a lot of the lakes and rivers. And then we had the heavy rain event. And you all saw the flooding way up north. We were all covering that. So, you know, this is a statewide phenomenon. You can't really escape it here in Michigan.
Well, and you know, you're retired, but you've had to put on the suit and tie a couple of different times as a meteorological expert to go into court and testify to some of these issues that have been brought to judges. What type of cases have you been a part of?
Well, you know, I was part of the Sanford and the Edenville Dam case up north. I had to determine how much rain fell in what period of time. And then some of these flooding cases down here in the metro area, you know, like, say, an entire neighborhood, all the basements flood, you know, the cities and the people that are suing cities, they all need to know how much rain fell in what period of time. Excuse me, guys. If this was, you know, was this the type of rain event that there is just no possible way our system, as it's designed, the infrastructure could have handled? Or was a particular rain event where the basements flooded, was it something that wasn't that? Was it something where there was a problem with the, you know, with the human intervention in the system or something? There was something, you know, there was something wrong, you know, with the system itself. So those things have to be determined by uncovering the facts. And the facts start with how much rain fell in what period of time. And I've been involved in a lot of those cases.
And, you know, we still, Paul, tend to call these events historic, once in a lifetime. Are those labels starting to lose the meaning?
Oh, absolutely. You know, like I say, you know, like, again, the example to, you know, my friend in Houston, you know, if you have a 500, you know, what used to be a rain event. Sorry, guys, a little hoarse this morning.
Okay.
A little, you know, the if you have a rain event that used to be so rare that statistically it would be expected to occur once every 500 to 1,000 years, okay? And that statistically is what it used to be. Those type of events now are becoming like once every, you know, 10-year events, once every 5-year events. I mean, like my friend in Houston, it happened 4 straight years down there. So it, like I say, we have changed what's normal. We have changed what's normal. And the way I like to – this is an analogy a lot of people can appreciate. It's like the steroid era in baseball. Back in the 90s, we saw Barry Bonds and you know, Sammy Sosa and Mark McGwire hitting all those home runs. They hit home runs before the steroids. It's not that they didn't hit home runs. It's just that the steroids enabled them to hit the ball farther. So some balls that were being caught on the warning track were now home runs, and some of the home runs were being hit farther. And it's the same thing with these rain events. As the planet warms, we evaporate more ocean water in the atmosphere, and that water in the atmosphere is what storms turn into precipitation. So we've basically put the atmosphere on steroids. And that's a very simple explanation, but that's exactly what has happened.
Some of those balls were being hit into San Francisco Bay, for example. Paul Gross, really appreciate it. Interesting look at what some of these changes are. Thank you.
Good to be with you guys, always.
Yeah, right. Thanks. Meanwhile, Delta cutting its free snack and drink service for flights shorter than 350 miles.
I can't get a pack of peanuts?
I don't think they even do peanuts anymore.
They don't do peanuts anymore?
The last couple of times I've been on Delta, it's been those...
The cookies?
The cookies.
Those are,
maybe pretzels?
The cookies are
There's
the
too
best,
many peanut allergies now. I don't even think they do peanuts anymore.
But the cookies, I forgot about
cookies. Cookies are fantastic.
They are.
Yeah. This all comes as growing pressure on the airline industry with the war in Iran, increased fees and, you know, jet fuel costs and check bag fees, all those things. Look, I don't need you. If I'm flying within 350 miles,
yeah,
the plane's not even at altitude yet, and then the drink service is coming down. They're like, please put your seatbelt on, prepare for arrival. And it's like, I don't need this. So, keep the card away. I don't need it.
Well, I mean, you just go to the little store in the airport and grab you a few things.
Get a water and be done.
Bring it on the airplane with you.
350 miles, you're going to be on the plane for 20 minutes.
But, yeah, exactly.
I don't think any – I mean, I'm sure people are going to be mad about it, but I don't see how
that's
it's
too
a,
short of
a big deal.
No.
Pistons win. They take a 1-0 series lead over the Cleveland Cavaliers last night down at LCA. We'll talk about it on the other side. It's JR Morning.